We're going to continue our discussion of authority as it is expressed through examples. And of course, this comes from some work that was done by Roy Caudill, who is the author of a little book called Walking by Faith. This is his lesson five in that book. I should point out that Roy Caudill is an attorney by profession. And so as you read through his discussion, you see some legalese that kind of creeps in here. I think it does it in spite of what he's trying to do. And you'll see it tonight. I'll show you where that really occurs. But we're going to continue our discussion. Suddenly, we talked about the rule of harmony last week, and we talked a little bit about the rule of materiality. And then we concluded last week with talking about the rule of uniformity. So we're going to expand that. We're going to continue our discussion. And tonight, we're going to talk about examples and the rule of what he called universal application. Everything that God expects of us in terms of our practice is within the realm of possibility for all people in all parts of the world in every age. The scope of the gospel is worldwide. Never forget that. And that's one of the things that so impresses me about the elements that Jesus chose to be a part of the Lord's Supper, the bread and the fruit of the vine. In every part of the world, bread is consumed, unleavened bread. And in every part of the world, everywhere across the globe, there is some vine that grows that produces a fruit that can yield its liquid. I remember living in Alaska, and that was one of the things that impressed me about the fruit of the vine. No matter where you live, there is some vine that grows that produces fruit. And that just reminds me, everything that Jesus expects of us is universally possible. Same with baptism. Baptism in water for the remission of sins is universally possible. There is no setting in which you cannot be baptized. I have baptized people in running cold water. I have baptized people in cold pools of water. I have baptized people in very accommodating, nice, warm pools where it was no problem. My grandfather was baptized in a stock pond on his farm, and they had to take an axe and chop a hole in the ice. But no matter where you are, water is available. And part of that is because water has to be available to sustain life. So water is always available. Autonomy and independence of equally prepared congregations is also universally available. No matter where you are, a group of people can come together and they can constitute a church. Now, they may not have elders, they may not have deacons, they may not have many of the things that we have in our commodious country. I mean, we have a wonderful building to meet in. We can be calm, we can be warm and dry, but no matter where you are, you can always constitute a church. So, some thoughts that you might have about this idea of examples and universally applicable examples. Yeah, Carol.
Well, it just makes me think that God never asks us to do anything that isn't possible. And the same thing is true here with the setup of how to get into the kingdom and what is needed. So.
Yeah. I've baptized people who were in the hospital. I've baptized people who were in prisons. And I have friends who were in the military who baptized people on battlefields. You can always find enough water. Sometimes it's not easy, but you can do it. So, yeah. Other thoughts?
I guess this speaks to the kind of the simplicity of the gospel and the simplicity of what God requires of us. And by simplicity, I mean it's not that it's not always easy. I don't mean the word easy, I mean simplicity. And sometimes in our human nature, we complicate things. You know, we have religious organizations where you have to have a priest that pronounces this or that. You have to go to confession, or you have to, there are just steps and things that you have to go through that we don't see in the scriptures, and it kind of belies this simplicity, right? And it almost puts a barrier in the way. If I don't have a priest around to bury me, or you know, to do what they do, then I'm up the creek, kind of, you know. And we've seen that over and over with a lot of our religious friends. They say, well, you know, I can't do that. I don't have a priest that will do that for me, or I don't. And I just think that this speaks so well to the simplicity that God intended. He didn't intend for us to monkey it all up with complicated rules and all of that. It's pretty straightforward, and he makes it available and accessible for everyone. And you were using the example in Alaska when we were working with the church in Barrow. I mean, they're up on the North Slope. They are up in Barrow, Alaska, which
That's as
is
far north as you can go. You
absolutely.
can't see, it's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there.
And they don't have grapevines, but they have other fruit that grows on vines. And you can make juice out of that fruit. And I think that that speaks to, I mean, I'm sure God will appreciate that. I think he's wise, but that'll speak to the wisdom, I think. And hopefully we can gain a little bit of that wisdom as well.
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting that during the early stages of the American colonies, when the colonists would get a little bit out of sorts with the English, one of the things that the English would do, the British would do, in order to enforce the rules, was they would say, okay, we're going to call all of the priests back home.
Can't take communion.
You can't be married because there's no priest to do it. And that, I think this really speaks to the wisdom of God. But we, like you said, we complicate it, we monkey it up, and we create problems for ourselves that we don't need to be creating. I guess it, you know, you could say, well, the fruit of the vine must be grape juice. But it doesn't say that because grape juice is not universally available. Unleavened bread is. The old British sailors called it hardtack. Okay. And now, if you live in Alaska and you live on the North Slope, you eat pilot bread. And pilot bread with peanut butter on it is one of their favorite snacks. I just can't imagine. But that's one of their favorite. They have unleavened bread. And we're familiar with that. So it's universally applicable. Now, here's where the legalese comes in Cogdill's experience. He talks about the rule of competence, which means if there is an expectation by God that we practice a certain thing, then the evidence that we can get from Scripture is sufficient to establish the claim that's made for it. Or it's if you're an attorney, that means it's competent to support the claim that's made for it. So the evidence from Scripture, in terms of examples, is always competent to support the claims that are made for it. Now, let me talk about the illustration of that. Maybe that makes it a little bit clearer. The expansion of elders' oversight that's suggested by some based on Acts 11, where the apostle took the contribution from different parts of the world to Jerusalem or to Judea and gave it to the elders in Judea, demands that if we were to make the argument that he gave it to the elders in Jerusalem and that they distributed it to churches over which they had no oversight, that would demand that the Jerusalem elders had been mentioned at that point. Jerusalem and its elders are not mentioned as recipients. It says the elders in Judea. It doesn't say Jerusalem. If we were to try to expand this based on saying that Jerusalem had elders and other people didn't, we would have to have some information that that was the case. But we don't have that information. So you can't make a claim for an application of an example that's based on evidence that won't support that claim. And the other thing that it would demand is that only the Jerusalem church had elders. And we don't know whether that was the case or not. Yeah, Bill.
Were the Jerusalem elders considered to be the apostles, or were there others that we know of?
No. An elder may have been an apostle. We know that Peter was. But the fact that they were apostles did not cause them to function as elders. Those are two separate offices. Okay. So the rule of competence, this one is a little, it's important when you try to examine what claims some people make for examples, but it's not something that we deal with very often. It's something that you need to be aware of, and anytime you make a claim based on an example, the example has to be competent to support the claim. Okay? Other questions, comments about this part of it? That one is a little complicated to kind of wrap your head around, but it's important to understand. And really, it's the only way to deal with the claim that's made that Acts the 11th chapter, verses 27 through 30, is an example of elders in one church overseeing the work that was done in other churches. So, again, he's an attorney, and attorneys talk funny. A rule of limited application. Examples only apply to the circumstances or set of facts under which the application is made in Scripture. So let's think about that for a minute. Somebody want to read 1 Corinthians 7? And let's look at verse 6 and then drop down and look at verses 25 through 27.
But this I say by way of concession, not of command. I think then that this is good in a view that the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. And are you bound to a wife? Do not seek release. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin should marry, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I am trying to spare you.
Okay. So Paul is giving examples of the way, and if you read all of 1 Corinthians 7, he frequently references himself in 1 Corinthians 7. How is that an example that has a limited application?
He was talking about a time of trial.
Okay.
And he was saying that it's better to not have all of the extra responsibility. And he's not saying that there's any sin, just that if you go ahead and do what is legal to do, that it will cause you extra trouble because of what's coming.
Yeah, you have to be concerned about your wife or your husband. Yeah, Kim.
I was just going to say, Ken, verses 25 through 27 read differently, but it says, now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it's good for you to remain as you are. So he identifies right there that it's this present crisis that kind of, I think, limits the application.
Right.
Because he identifies it, and he's identifying it as something that's coming from him. It's kind of like, you know, if I were you, this is the way I would do it because of the circumstances that we're currently under.
And that would be a fine approach. But it's not an approach that everyone must follow. Yeah, Bill.
He's speaking in the first person, so I'm going to hear say.
I'm sorry, say that again. He's speaking in the first person.
So nothing is hearsay that he's saying.
Okay. He's applying it to himself. This is the decision that I made. Yeah, Carol.
But it's just sort of a strong suggestion because he knows what's coming up. It's just like somebody would tell somebody before they go ride all the rides at the fair, maybe it's best that you not eat a whole bunch of junk food so that you don't throw up. I mean, you know, the circumstance says don't do this, but you know.
But then we say that's true. But then we say, well, you shouldn't eat junk food at the fair. No, that's taking it away from the circumstance in which it was originally applied.
Yes.
And you can't do that. You have to be careful not to apply it beyond the original circumstance. Anything else that you can, that any other comments about this? Look at 1 Corinthians 14. Let's look at verses 2 through 5. Then again, understand, this is an example of something that was a practice at some times in the first century. 1 Corinthians 14, verses 2 through 5.
For one who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men, but to God, for no one understands. But in his spirit he speaks mysteries. But one who prophesies speaks to men for edification and exhortation and consolation. One who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but one who prophesies edifies the church. Now I wish that you all spoke in tongues, but even more that you would prophesy. And greater is one who prophesies than one who speaks in tongues, unless he interprets, so that the church may receive edifying.
Okay. So, in the circumstance in which there is no one to interpret, should you speak in tongues? Even if you can. He said no. You modify what you do based on the circumstance in which you find yourself. And we'll talk about this in terms of Bring a Friend Sunday. We are expecting to invite visitors. So what we do should not be confusing to our visitors. We need to, we still worship God. And he would not say in 1 Corinthians 14 that you don't worship God. He's just saying, be aware of the circumstance in which you are functioning at this particular time. Now, we all understand we don't have the ability to speak in tongues anymore. Okay? So that's gone away. We don't have the ability to prophesy. That's gone away. But it was practiced in the early church. It was for a specific time. We do have some things that we can do that are like this, and we'll be doing that on Bring a Friend Sunday. Comments? Yeah.
Or you just might sort of apply it to nowadays, that just because you can say something and you have cogitate a question doesn't mean the question should be asked unless you have an idea that it can be asked. And when you do hyperbole, you're just, doing something that's not edifying.
Yeah, and we need to not answer questions that people didn't ask. I think that's a really important thing for us to understand, and something that I have to be reminded of all the time. Don't ask questions or don't answer questions that nobody asked. I remember when, I can't remember whether it was Mandy or Jenny. I think it was Mandy said when Kim was pregnant with Jenny, Mandy was like 3. She said, where do babies come from? There's 2. Where do babies come from? And I'm thinking, oh, no, here it comes. And I'm going through this long thing in my mind. How am I going to explain this? Oh, my. I'm sweating bullets, Kim said, from Mommy's tummy. And Mandy said, okay. She gave the answer to the question that Mandy was asking. And sometimes we need to be aware of that. Sometimes we answer questions that nobody asked. And I'm one of the worst offenders about answering questions that nobody asked, except me. And sometimes I think we... Yeah, go ahead, Jim.
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay. Rescue me.
We Well, you referenced Bring a Friend Sunday. I know the meeting that we had with the people who were kind of trying to put it together, somebody made a great comment and said, whoever does the Lord's Supper talk can kind of explain what we're doing. Well, when we gather as a church, we don't always explain every single aspect of the Lord's Supper and why we're doing what we're doing. We have reminders, but we all know that because we're all believers and we all participate in that. But when we have visitors, we're going to anticipate some questions, and I think that's okay. So in a case like that, you anticipate that this is probably something different that these people haven't seen, or if they're churched, another way to say that, they might celebrate something similar to it monthly or quarterly or something like that. So it's kind of nice to give a framework for it when we know that we're going to have a lot of visitors. And so that's a way that we can tailor our worship where we wouldn't normally do that every single time. But on that particular Sunday, it's probably a good practice to sort of try to anticipate some questions that may come up.
Yeah.
So yeah.
The example is taking the supper. And we'll do that. We do that all the time. And it's just sometimes we explain more than we do other times. And sometimes I think it's important to understand that you have to let people grow enough to ask the question. I was talking in our Bible class about people called me Reverend Dean Cruz or something like that. In fact, one time I was even a right reverend. Or was it a very reverend? I was the very reverend Dean Cruz. I don't know exactly what that means. Somebody said that, and I thought, okay, just let it go. They're talking about me, and eventually we'll get to a point in their growth where we'll talk about what they're meaning when they say the very reverend Dean Cruz. But right now, we're trying to get something else accomplished. So, you know, there will be people that call me pastor, and now it's appropriate. Before it wasn't appropriate, but they don't mean what I think they mean by that. I'm not going to correct them. I'm just going to let them grow, and eventually we'll get to the point where we'll talk about that. So I think that's important. Yeah. Carol? No comment. Let's look at Acts 2, verse 45, and then we'll couple Acts 4 at verse 32 with that.
And they began selling their property and possessions and were sharing them with all as anyone might have need. And then 4 at verse 32. And the congregation of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and not one of them claimed that anything belonging to him was his own, but all things were common property to them.
Okay. What do you see there? Is this an indication that everybody who worships here must sell everything that they own and they must put it into a common pool?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a unique circumstance at that time and place.
Okay. So they responded to the circumstance of that time and place. And that is an example of a way that we might respond to a similar circumstance, but if we're not in a similar circumstance, we don't respond in that way. Yeah, Kim? Mandy?
I think we have to include 244. It says that all those who believed were together and had all things in common. And that's the same that we see over in 32 in the congregation of those who believe were of one heart. They came together for the purpose.
Okay.
Based upon the current situation.
Right.
It's not just because you're a part of this, you're in.
It is, and it is an example of a practice that was conducted under the guidance of the apostles. The apostles were there in Jerusalem, so I know this is something that we could do. But I think we would go too far if we said, you must all sell everything that you have and give it to the common fund. Yeah, Carol.
It's also the structure around the fact that there's a need in a certain time period. And I remember hearing about some church somewhere that I think everybody decided that they weren't going to have house insurance or medical insurance or whatever. And if anybody had a need, the congregation was going to take care of themselves. And that worked just fine until all of the sick people found out that this congregation didn't take care of you. And then they couldn't do it because it wasn't structured that way, because you don't have a limited input.
Right.
But the output was limited.
Yeah. Yeah. So just be careful. Well, yeah, Andrew.
I think we got to kind of like put our shoes into what was going on in that time frame. When you're looking at some of these verses and you're doing some of these studies, I mean, I found out when I was studying for the Galatians class this morning, I sometimes, had to think back, okay, what was going on in this time? What was going on in this scene? And I know Kim brought that up in class a couple months ago, and it's really stuck with me when I study on my own, is that you got to kind of at times put yourself into their perspective, and you got to put it in their world. Now, nowadays, when we do this, if something like a similar situation came up, maybe. But, like with the Galatian class that we were talking about, for them, their yoke of slavery right then and there was the law. But for us today, it could be something completely different.
Yeah.
So I think especially with these verses, we have to put ourselves into that perspective of what was going on at this time. Why were they, what were they doing it for? Why were they doing it?
Yeah. And I have considered, and one of the things I was talking with the other elders, one of the things that I'm working on just for my own knowledge is taking the books of the Bible and I'm looking specifically at the New Testament, trying to figure out what's the best evidence for when they were written, and then correlate when those books were written to what was going on with Roman persecution. So Roman persecution was really bad for a time. Then it got a little bit better. Then it got worse. There was Jewish persecution, and it didn't correspond to Roman persecution. So what's going on with Jewish persecution? What's going on in the society that these people were a part of? And what was happening in Corinth might not be what's happening in Jerusalem. So that's one of the things that I'm kind of looking at. And we're going to put a big circular timeline on the wall outside of the classrooms. It looks at what's going on with the Israelites and what was going on with the Persians at that time. So it's just a really important concept that we have to put ourselves into the mindset of those people and understand what the instruction meant to them. So I don't know if we'll do a discussion of that. If there's any interest in doing that discussion, then I don't have that completed. But it's really interesting to look at when the books were written and put that on a timeline, because most of the books were written in this fairly short period. You had some that were written earlier, some that were written later, but most of them are in this very short period. So it's really an interesting idea. And it helps us with understanding examples. Okay? Very important concept. Don't extend the example beyond the circumstance in which the example arose. Okay, last one, he calls it the rule of exclusion. I call it a rule of inclusion, but that's just the way that I try to approach it. He says, when there is no precept, example, or inference to support a practice, such a practice is excluded. I say that everything that we do must be supported by a precept, an example, or an inference. Okay? I don't tend to look at exclusion as much as I say, if it's not supported, then it shouldn't be a part of our practice. And that's because of my understanding, my approach to serving God. If God didn't say to do it, it's not good. And I kind of start with 2 Timothy 3. All scripture is given by the inspiration of God. It's profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect. And that means full grown, that the man of God may be full grown, thoroughly furnished unto every good work. So if it doesn't furnish us to do that, then what that tells me is it's not a good work. It may seem like it is, but I can't say that because it seems like it is to me, it is by definition a good work. I have to say by definition, it's not, because God didn't tell me to do it. That yields the same conclusion. If God is silent, it excludes. I say, if God is silent, it just doesn't include it in the practice that God wants you to be involved in. Okay? Other comments about exclusion or inclusion? You can approach it from either of those perspectives. Yeah, Bill.
Do we have an example for having our own building?
Yes, we have an example of. We certainly have an inference that they had a place to meet. Now, how they provided for it, we don't know. But we do have an example of them meeting in buildings. Because we know Eutychus fell out of a third floor window, or a third floor loft. So that had to be a building of some sort. So, yeah, I can say that there is an example of providing for a building.
Or a place to gather, because in Africa they may want to be sitting with a thatched roof over the top and bedrooms.
Sure.
So it's a place for us to gather to hear the word.
Sure.
And you couldn't very well sit out in the you could, but it wouldn't be as prosperous if you're sitting out in the rain. And if you bought songbooks or something like that, you would run them. So, I mean, there are a few things that are just applicable as to the situation that having a roof over your head can
right
help.
But you don't have to have a building. You can meet by the riverside, and they did in Philippi. That worked really well for them. Now, when it's 30 below, you need a place to stay warm. But you don't have to have one. You can 30 below, you can put on enough clothes and you can go out and sit down on the grass.
Grass?
Well, on the snow. Okay. Other comments? Well, that concludes our discussion of examples, at least as it was described by Roy Coghill. And again, I would just mention, we have several copies of this book in the library here at the church. If you would like to borrow a copy of that book, then by all means, take advantage of that. And I wish I was so smart that I had organized this. I'm not. I didn't. So I want to give credit where credit is due. Is there anything that we can do to help you in your spiritual walk right now? I know everybody that's here is a baptized believer, but that doesn't mean that we still don't have needs. We don't have reason to pray for each other. So if there's something we can do to help you, then we want you to let us know.